Let's open our Bibles to 1 Kings. We're in chapter 12. And as you turn there, I'm reminded of something that was left off with. We only covered half a chapter last week in chapter 11. And I was struck by something about Jeroboam. And you remember, Jeroboam is one of the sources of adversity that the Lord raised up against Rehoboam. Rehoboam is the son of Solomon. Jeroboam was one of Solomon's trusted right-hand men, a leader in his administration. The Lord appeared to Rehoboam in chapter 11 and told him that basically he was going to rip part of the nation away from Solomon's family, not Solomon personally, but Solomon's family, and leave him with leave Solomon's family with just a small portion of the kingdom. This was interesting to me, as it appears as if God raised this man up to do this. Jeroboam seems to have been encouraged by the prophet that was sent to the prophet Ahijah. In chapter 11 is where it talks about this. And that troubled me a little bit, I have to say. It troubles me because I don't like to think that God raises up people to bring division in the church. I say this because I've heard several people in my ministry life who believed they were raised up to destroy the church or to divide, to bring division, that God called them to do it. In a sense, they appear to be similar to a Jeroboam who was raised up to divide the kingdom. And it troubled me. I wanted to know really what that was about, so I started to seek the Lord about it and try to get some wisdom there. Does God actually inspire someone to do something as evil as division? When we look at the Proverbs, we see that God hates when brothers are divided. He doesn't like that. It's an abomination to him. It's something that disturbs him. So I can't imagine that he would raise someone up to do something as evil as divide a people. I know that well-intentioned individuals believe that it's possible for God to raise them up to do such a thing, but I think we need to look again. It tells us in James chapter 1 that God is not tempted by evil, nor does he tempt man to do evil. He doesn't lead someone down a pathway that would ultimately result in that person sinning against God. That wouldn't be fair. So where does such a behavior happen? How does that happen? Where does it come from? It tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13 that there is no temptation that has overtaken us except that which is common to man. And with every temptation, there seems that God provides us with an escape, a way out. And I think that what we learn from this is that God does not remove temptation from our lives, but instead, he provides us with an alternative to the temptation. In other words, he keeps it that way so as not to violate something very precious to us as human beings, something that we almost insist upon: free choice, free will. If God fooled us, tricked us, led us down a pathway of temptation only to let us sin, it seems like he would have the advantage, the upper hand, and it would be something that was completely out of our ability to choose. I don't think God would do that. In fact, I'm certain he doesn't. He provides instead temptations to do good, to do the right things. Incentives is a better word, perhaps, than temptation. God knows our actions even before we do them. Once again, as we study about God, we know that he's outside of time. He already knows what Jeroboam was going to do. And so it seems as if God, knowing what Jeroboam was already destined to do or planning on doing in his heart, in his mind, it seems God provided an alternative. And that alternative was, once you're going to overthrow the kingdom and divide the kingdom, follow me. We see this in the end of chapter 11, and it tells us there in verse 38, It shall be, if you heed all that I command you, walk in my ways and do what is right in my sight to keep my commandments and my as my servant David did, then I will be with you and build for you an enduring house. It's almost as if God is saying, I know what you're going to do. And I'm all right with it in that I want to give you an opportunity to follow me. Because God not only knows what Jeroboam is about to do, he knows what Rehoboam was going to do. He knew that Rehoboam was going to turn away from him. He knew that Solomon's son was going to go as far away from God as possible, and there was no question that was going to happen. So God is looking for a vessel, someone who's going to follow in his ways, because he doesn't violate our choice. He could overthrow this, but all through the history of the Jewish people, we see where God is constantly looking for someone who will do his will because they want to, not because they have to. He knew Jeroboam would rebel. He knew that Rehoboam would turn away from God. And he tried to incite them or tempt them toward good. What about the biblical explanation for this, or a biblical example of this? And I think all the way back to Cain and Abel in the very beginning in Genesis chapter 4. It was there where God appears to or reveals himself to Cain when Cain was contemplating in his heart the evil of killing his own brother Abel. And it was there that God appears to him and says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? Because Cain was very upset at the offering that was, in a sense, less pleasing to God than the offering that Abel gave. So Cain was upset. If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, or if you do not do as I've asked you to, then he says, sin lies at the door. And he said, its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. The temptation is there. God knew what he wanted to do. God knew that Cain had in his heart to do evil, to commit murder. He knew it, but God said, don't do it. Here's your way of escape. Here is your way out. Choose to do the right thing instead of the wrong thing. But God doesn't intervene in the affairs of men. In the choices of men, he lets us make our choices. And with his sovereignty, he allows his will to play itself out. It's just that some people are no longer going to be a part of that will because of their own choice. When I think of these things, I can't help grieving over the history, the children of Israel. But it's not the history of the children of Israel. You wonder, why in the world are we having to go through all these stories of the kings? What does it have to do with anything? All of the kings, and in particular the kings of Judah, are the very relatives of Jesus Christ, the Messiah. You turn to Matthew, in the very first chapter, all of the names that we're going to cover in Kings are listed in Matthew, the first chapter. So they're all important. They all bring us out of this evil, out of this darkness. God is somehow able to bring forth the light of our Savior, Jesus Christ, through this lineage that is so distorted and so disappointing when we see it. And God constantly having to intervene with options, with offers to do good. But Jeroboam would choose to do bad, very bad. Chapter 12, as we come into this chapter of disappointment, it really begins Israel's woe, Israel's backsliding, Israel's downward spiral away from God. Backsliding is something that affects all of us as we look at it and we say, I can't believe I did that. And backsliding is the process by which we get ourselves into a habit or a practice of sin, and we look back at the last however long we've been sliding, and we say, I can't believe I've slipped so far away from God. And the nation of Israel is a picture of the Christian life that turns its back away from God over and over and over again. It's sad. We realize that these kings, the further from David they went, the further from God they went. And the further we get away from God, the darker it becomes in our lives. And we don't want to go the way of these kings, but instead we find out that in this whole story here, we're going to find about 20 kings of Israel throughout the book of Kings here, 1st and 2nd Kings, 20 kings. And in those kings of Israel, not one of them walked with God. 20 kings, not one of them walked with God. Now, here is the division. And the division will take place, and we're going to talk about it around verse 16 of chapter 12, is where the division of Israel takes place. Israel and Judah, they divide. This is going to forever be that way. They will never unite again until they're united in captivity some 200, 300 years later, 360 years later. It's a sad day for the people of Israel, because their nation will be divided. So let's start in chapter 12. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king, make Rehoboam the king. Solomon is dead now. Remember, he didn't like to hear the story of Jeroboam, so Solomon started to chase him, to kill him in verse 40 of chapter 11. And with that, then, Rehoboam became the king, the son of Solomon. In verse 42, in the period that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. And Solomon rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, his father. And Rehoboam, his son, reigned in his place. And sadly, there was no repentance on Solomon's part, which left a terrible legacy for his children to follow. And Rehoboam is going to use Solomon as his example. And that's a very unfortunate thing. So Solomon went to Shechem, or Rehoboam went to Shechem. They were going to make him king. And it happened that when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard it, he was still in Egypt, for he had fled from the presence of King Solomon and had been dwelling in Egypt, that they sent and called him. They sent and called him. Someone was working for him in the sense of keeping him informed of the affairs of Israel. Someone who had known the prophecy, known that he was going to take charge, known that he had an ability to make a following, to create a following of people that would lead to this rebellion, to this division. And it tells us that they called for him, that they sent and called him in verse 3. Then Jeroboam and the whole assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, "Your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father as his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you." His heavy yoke is implying the taxes. Remember, Solomon built very elaborate buildings. He built palaces, and he built the temple of God. He covered everything he could with gold and precious metals from all over the region, brought in cedars from Lebanon and all kinds of amazing things that Solomon built. Somebody had to pay for this. It was paid for by the people of Israel, who were taxed, and they were taxed severely, heavily. Many of them were recruited by Solomon to work and to oversee the many, many slaves that were used by Solomon to build all these things. You know, the pyramids were built by slaves in the same way. Much of what we know from the Jewish culture was built by the slaves of their enemies. Jews weren't necessarily the slaves who built those things at that time. It was illegal for the Jews to be slaves at that time. So these people got together with Jeroboam as their leader and said, "You know, this is a heavy tax load you've put upon us. Now that your father's gone and all of these buildings are done, you think you can lighten the load a little bit?" So he said to them in verse 5, "Depart for 3 days, then come back to me." And so the people departed. Now, this was obviously what Jeroboam chose to use as his battle. This is what he was going to use as his excuse to divide the people. And he gave them an opportunity to lighten the load, but perhaps it was much of a Moses complex that he had. Set my people free, let my people go. The tax burden is too much. Set us free from it. And Rehoboam, being a rookie king, didn't exactly know how to respond to this. So he said, "Give me a couple days to think about it and then come back." 3 days he asked for. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father Solomon while he lived, and he said, how do you advise me to answer these people? A couple of things here. He consulted the elders. Who were these elders? They were the ones who watched Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived on the face of the earth, listened to the wisdom, learned from him, and Solomon was the one that actually trained these elders. You would assume, just by logic, I suppose, that these elders were bright men, intelligent. They must have gleaned from the wisdom of Solomon, and therefore one would assume they were wise elders, wise men. It was good that Rehoboam would consult these men. There is something else in this verse that's a little disappointing. How do you advise me to answer these people? It seems he has now a superiority complex. The words these people implies it's like these knuckleheads, these silly people, dumb sheep. You ever hear that? And I know we laugh about that. God has called us sheep. And very often what happens is, and I've heard many preachers talk about how sheep are dumb. If you ever hear that, you know what they're saying. The preacher's calling you dumb. I'd be insulted. I mean, sheep are not the brightest candles in the chandelier, no question. But that's not why God calls us sheep. He calls us sheep because they're precious to a shepherd. Precious. And unfortunately, that's an animal that's been given a bad rap. And I think what we see here is a king who views his people as dumb. Pathetic. People who don't know any better. These people. And anytime you've got a leader who starts seeing them and us kind of a thing, you've got a serious problem. And that's what we see here. These people. And it isn't long that Rehoboam is going to experience the disappointment of treating these people like that. And they spoke to him saying, if you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever. This is really good wisdom. And if you ever wanted to really do something interesting, and I'm going to try as best I can as we go through Kings, is to try and point out lessons that we should learn from these leaders and from these people. One of the things that we can learn from Rehoboam is how to divide people. Probably one of the things that we can learn from Rehoboam is how to create a division. And the way to do that is to be an unteachable person. How many of you, if you were to be honest with yourselves, could say that you're teachable or unteachable? Could you really examine your heart and your way in this, your life in this way? Are you a teachable person? Are you someone when someone comes to you and says, I really want to share something that you kind of did, and how do you respond to that? Now, all of us probably at first would get a little, upset about it. I don't like being corrected. I don't like being told that I'm wrong in an area. None of us do. But can you learn from it? Rehoboam went to the wise men of Israel who were wise, and this was very wise advice. Basically, the wisdom that comes from these elders was, serve the people. If you'll be nice to them, serve them. Hear what they say, because they're right. These men could have said, if we were to elaborate more on what they were saying, is we know your father, Solomon, taxed way too much. We can cut back on the taxes now. It doesn't have to be so high. We can cut back. And if you do that, these people will serve you the rest of your life, gladly. But he rejected the advice which the elders had given him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. The word reject there means he dismissed it outright. It was almost as if they gave him the wisdom and he went, oh man, you got to be kidding me. Hey buddies, what do you guys think? And of course, the buddies had a whole different thing. These were the young men, younger men, and young, we're looking at about 40s here. These men were in their 40s. It tells us later, I think in Chronicles, where Rehoboam was about 41, 42, I think, when he became the king. So his buddies probably were anywhere from 35, 45, 50. They were right around in there, and these were the young men. That's good news for some of us, huh? And he answered them and spoke good word. I'm sorry, in verse 8, he said these were the men who grew up with him, who stood before him. So he's creating a new court now of younger men. He said to them, "What advice do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, 'Lighten the yoke which your father put on us'?" Well, then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, "Thus you should speak to this people who have spoken to you, saying, 'Your father made your yoke heavy, but you make it lighter on us.' Thus you shall say to them, 'My little finger shall be thicker than my father's waist.'" In other words, you ain't seen nothing yet. You think his yoke was heavy. Wait till you see mine. So in other words, the young men were saying, answer harshly. The older men, the wiser men were saying, answer gently, softly, and give the people a little bit of a break. And it's very important that this was the advice that should have been heeded, and he would have avoided the division. Relationships are that way. Oh, sure, we can look at a leader and say that's how a leader is, but what about relationships? You know, there are some relationships that the people don't listen to each other. They don't take each other's advice. There are some where a person will refuse to admit that they were wrong in anything, and often they wind up bickering, fighting, and even dividing over that. Obviously, humility is needed for someone to be able to say, you know, you're right, I kind of was wrong in that area, and I apologize. Humility is needed. Not only that, when you enter into any type of leadership, and in particular spiritual leadership, we all enter into such an experience with very little experience. We're not born as leaders. We're not born as spiritual people. We're growing at it. And as we're growing, the reality is we're going to make mistakes in our growth process. And for some reason, pride keeps us from being able to admit that we made mistakes. And God would have us humble ourselves. God would have us do the opposite of what Rehoboam is going to do here. This was now his choice. The elders gave him wisdom, whereas the young men gave him a reaction, a strong reaction. Nowhere do we see that Rehoboam prayed and sought the Lord. He sought the advice of men, which is not a bad thing in itself. But a third step was left out of Rehoboam's decision-making process. You go to the old men, you go to the young men, and you take both to the Lord. Lord, what's the right thing to do? That's the wise thing to do. He left that part out. Well, in verse 11, "Now, whereas my father put a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips. I will chastise you with scourges." In other words, a scourge is what they whipped Jesus with, the cat of nine tails, that whip that at the end of it was tied bits of metal and glass and pottery so that it ripped the flesh apart in a very nasty way. Not just a whip that kind of encouraged you to do things quickly, but it was a punishing whip that would rip your flesh and you could die from it. In other words, he's saying the advice was scare them, provide fear. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day as the king had directed, saying, "Come back to me the third day." Then the king answered the people roughly, so we know which direction he chose, and he rejected the advice which the elders had given him. And he spoke to them according to the advice of the young men, saying, "My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges." So the king did not listen to the people, for the turn of events was from the Lord, that he might fulfill his word, which the Lord had spoken by Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Now when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, saying, "What share have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now see to your own house, O David." So Israel departed to their tents. So we see again the choice was given to Rehoboam to do what's good, to do what's bad. He chose what was bad. The choice was given there. And here we see this is what the Lord planned all along. He knew the events, how they were going to take place already. That's why, in a sense, he tried to recruit Jeroboam earlier, before Solomon died. He tried to prepare Jeroboam prior to Rehoboam being raised up to be king, because he knew Rehoboam was going to destroy the people, was going to divide the nation. And so we see this reaction brought another negative reaction. And so Jeroboam said, "That's it. We have no share. We have no part in this. It's all about David's family. It's all about him. So all you guys can take your people and do what you want with them. We're going to go off and become our own people. We have no inheritance anyway. So you take care of your own thing." So Israel departed to their tents. But it says Rehoboam reigned over the children of Israel who dwelt in the cities of Judah. Now, he was reigning as if he was totally unaware that this rebellion was so strong. He thought that was the end of it. In verse 18, King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was in charge of the revenue, a tax collector, the IRS. He sent the IRS, but all Israel stoned him with stones, and he died. Therefore, King Rehoboam mounted his chariot in haste to flee to Jerusalem. This was the first indication that there was a problem. He didn't realize there was a problem. He thought that this strong talk was going to end it all. And suddenly they killed his IRS agent. And now he realizes we've got a problem. And so he jumps in his chariot and hightails it as fast as he can to Jerusalem, because he was going to be safe there. That is the capital of the Judean reign, or the people of Judah. That's where the capital would be. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. And this is really, these verse 16 through 19 is where the division took place. It's where it happened. And they would never be united again until they were united only in captivity for a time. And still to this day, you see, there's great division in that land to this day. Now, we're going to see even more division in the scripture here as we continue on. In verse 20, "Now it came to pass when all Israel heard that Jeroboam had come back, they sent for him and called him to the congregation and made him king over all Israel. There was none who followed the house of David except for, or but for, the tribe of Judah only." And actually, Benjamin would join that tribe as well. And so Benjamin and Judah remained in the southern part of Israel, and that was the kingdom of Judah. And the northern kingdom would be the kingdom of Israel. And so now there's two separate things. And you need to understand this, because as we go through this, you're going to see one king is the king of Israel, another king is the king of Judah. And if you miss this chapter here, you're going to be a little bit confused as we go through the next several books of the Old Testament, Kings and Chronicles. They're going to tell us similar stories. If you missed it, you'll get confused. Remember, 20 kings of Israel, all evil. 19 kings over Judah. And out of those 19 kings, only 8 of them will do good in the sight of the Lord. All of the others would do evil. But the nice thing is the good ones lasted a long time. So here we have the problem now of this division, and we'll begin to look at what happens because of that. So verse 21, "And when Rehoboam came to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 chosen men who were warriors, to fight against the house of Israel, that he might restore the kingdom to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon." So he's going to battle against his own people to force them to become one, to force them under his rule, under his reign once again. This division thing wasn't sitting well with Rehoboam, and he was going to make them fall under his rule. "But the word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God, saying, 'Speak to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, to all the house of Judah and Benjamin and to the rest of the people, saying, thus says the Lord, you shall not go up nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Let every man return to his house, for this thing is from me. Therefore, they obeyed the word of the Lord and turned back according to the word of the Lord. So God allowed it. Was he happy about it? I don't think so. But he allowed it. In the New Testament, you come into the book of Acts, you see where Paul and Barnabas were two buddies working together in the ministry. They have an argument. They divide. They split up. The great apostle Paul, I don't want to hang with you anymore. And Barnabas saying, well, you think that's bad? I don't want to hang with you. And so they split up in the New Testament. That's shame. It's what happens in relationships when pride gets the best of us. And we split up and we don't talk to each other anymore. And we don't see each other anymore. We don't want anything to do with each other anymore. And it's primarily pride, because I don't want to admit that I've done wrong, or you're too pigheaded to see what you've done, that you're wrong and you're wrong and I'm wrong and you're wrong and I'm wrong, and back and forth and back and forth. And the result is we don't talk to each other anymore. But sometimes it seems God allows such things to happen. Why? Perhaps it is because he doesn't want to violate our free choice, yes, but at the same time, it seems that God has a way of allowing such things to work themselves out to bring about something that we can't see. In this particular case, God isolates Judah. He isolates Judah as something that allows us to be able to see where Jesus' roots were, in a sense, his human roots, as he comes through this family of Judah, not the other nations or the other tribes of Israel, but Judah. And so perhaps that's one way we can look at it. It gives us an easier track to follow. God allowed it, but he wasn't happy with it. Then Jeroboam, verse 25, built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. Also, he went out from there and built Penuel. Now, when it says he built these places, he really means he fortified them. He made them strong cities so that they can be defended easier. Now, Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord of Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. We're giving insight into the heart of Jeroboam, his insecurities. Jeroboam now is the king of Israel, not the king of Judah. Judah is reigning in the south over Rehoboam is reigning over Judah in the south, and he's doing his own thing. He's trying to accept this division. But Jeroboam is now in the north. Here's the problem. The Jewish people have been instructed that the only place of worship is where? Jerusalem. And they know that three times a year they are required by God's law, the males are required to return to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices at the one place of sacrifice or worship, which was the temple, which Solomon built. And so all of these people of the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom, were required by God's law to return to Jerusalem for worship. And Jeroboam saying, this is completely unacceptable. Because they're going to travel down south there, they're going to offer worship, and they're going to say, what are we doing fighting amongst ourselves? We should be brothers. We should be together. Why did we follow Jeroboam? We shouldn't have done that. And so Jeroboam is now sensing insecurity, but it tells us the secret of his heart, the secret motive of his heart. Jeroboam liked the fact that he was in control of the kingdom. He didn't have the spiritual depth to be able to trust God to hold on to the kingdom. And so he begins to do something to manipulate. The lesson we can learn from Jeroboam is do not be a leader motivated by fears and insecurities. And in particular, do what's right, not what's easy. Boy, that's big, very big. Do what's right, Christians, not what's easy. The easy thing, of course, is to be able to do the thing that the people will be happy with. Jeroboam started to do things that would please the people. That's a very serious thing. Rehoboam didn't care to please the people at all. Whereas Jeroboam, he wanted to do anything that he could to keep the people to himself, to hold on to them. And it made him a bit of a maniac, in a sense. Watch what happens. Therefore, the king asked advice and made two calves of gold and said to the people, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt." Now, to me, it seems this should have been something that stuck out like a sore thumb. I mean, this golden calf, didn't they do that once before? Didn't it end up in a real bad way? I mean, I can't believe that anybody would have fallen for this, but they did. An entire nation did. How did he get the people to fall for it? Well, he convinced them that it was best for them. But we know the secret of his heart. This was really best for him. So the people wouldn't travel down south. He made it so that they could stay up north here. He made two golden calves and he says, "These are your gods. These are the ones that led you out of the nation of Egypt." In essence, he creates his own religion. And he now gives it to the people. "These are your gods. Make of them what you will. If you want to worship the God of the sun, that's fine. Use the calf to represent that. Do whatever you want to do. But don't travel down south. That's too far. Why do you people need to go all the way down there? It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem." And the words "up to Jerusalem" are always said up because Jerusalem's surrounded by mountains. And so before you can get into Jerusalem, you have to go up and come down. So it's just a phrase. It's just a saying in that it's up to Jerusalem. Literally, Jerusalem's in the southern part of or in Judah, which is in the south. And the northern kingdom is where Israel is. Well, this is an interesting thing, an interesting development, as he set up one of the calves in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Dan is in the northern part. In fact, when we go to Israel, we visit Dan, and the remnants of this place of worship is there. We visit this place, and we'll go to that place where they actually offered sacrifices to this calf. Now, this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. Imagine, it became sin for them. They turned away. He made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. You see, he opened it up. He opened it up. He's creating his own religion. God specifically designated the Levites as the priests. They were the priests. Well, he's saying, well, we're not going to be so restrictive. You know, that religion was such a restrictive religion, not in our religion. We're going to open it up. See, this becomes, like we say, people pick and choose their religion. That's what he's doing. He's picking and choosing what he wants. And anyone can be a priest now. You can be a priest. It doesn't matter what family you're from. We'll let you all be priests if you want. And so Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 18th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And at Bethel, he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. And so he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised in his own heart. This is his own religion. And he got the entire nation to follow him, his own religion. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burned incense. What a sad day. A sad day. This is the guy that God specifically said in verse 38 of chapter 11, "If you'll follow me, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to give you everything if you'll just follow me." What does he do? As soon as he feels insecure, as soon as he feels the first inkling that it's possible these people are going to run away, he deceives them. He manipulates them. Very unfortunate. But something that happens very often, insecurity does that. Insecurity causes us to do foolish things, to make compromises with our lives, to say and do things to people, to make promises that we really don't want to be bound to, but we make them anyway for fear that we're going to lose them. I've seen Christian pastors behave like this, where they do the easy thing instead of the right thing. Ultimately, it leads to demise, it leads to division, it leads to the very thing that they were trying to avoid nonetheless. Instead of doing what's right, they did the thing that was right for the moment. By so doing, in a sense, they set up their own religion, their own way of doing things, being led by a disgruntled people, an unhappy people. Jeroboam really went too far. In his heart, his desire was to keep the people. His fear was that he would lose them. I think church history is filled with such ministries, such churches, where pastors will do whatever is necessary to keep the people, threatening them, calling them Korah, the evil ones, the rebellious ones. And I know of a ministry where anyone who would leave the church should be considered anathema, evil, wicked. Don't hang out with that person. If you didn't jump through the right hoops, do the things the right way, it became brutality. And it was all rooted in an insecurity to hold on to something that in the Christian world does not belong to you anyway. And a Christian leader needs to understand that they belong to God. God's people belong to God. That's why we call them God's people, God's sheep. And as we get further on in the Old Testament, we'll see that God is going to rebuke these leaders and others like them because they forgot that very simple truth. They're my people, God says. They're mine. And you've mistreated them. And God's concern is that they would be sheep without a shepherd, that they would be sheep that were constantly abused and mistreated. And no way do we see the Lord calling them dumb or any other thing, but just simple and needy and helpless. And the promise in Jeremiah is that God would raise up shepherds who would care for them, feed them, and teach them after his word. That's God's desire. That's God's desire for his people, and that's my desire in that it is my prayer. I want to be one of those leaders, one of those shepherds that is a good shepherd. I'm imperfect. I'm not capable of being perfect, though I know you require it of me. As we all want that of our leaders. Let me just help you right now to get over that. I'm not the perfect leader you wish for. And I can tell you also, he doesn't exist on this earth. With God's help, we look beyond our faults. With God's help, we understand that humans are weak and frail and will definitely falter and make mistakes. With God's help, we do what we can to serve together, to work together, to become people after God's heart together. And with God's help, we're going to make a difference in our community, reaching people who have needs like we have, and to make a difference as we grow in love with God and with one another, in agape love, true love, good love, the highest form of love. And that's the love that overlooks faults. That's the love that covers a multitude of sins. That's what God would want us to do with one another, to forgive one another as Christ has forgiven us. Here we see, unfortunately, the sad story of what happens too often in Christian communities. And I, for one, would like to teach on those things as we go through so we can avoid the same types of pitfalls in relationships. And probably there are more than one of us in this room going through relational problems, whether it's with our church or whether it's with our husband or our wife or family member or a church member. God help us to be forgiving and loving, because love covers a multitude of sins.